This is the title: Days, Dates, Times, and Seasons. Mr. Armstrong used to say that the Bible is about one-third prophecy. I can't remember if he ever cited the source for that particular statistic, that particular percentage. I'm kind of wondering if it's not a little bit higher, maybe much higher than that, when you consider a lot of things within the Bible record. So whether it's a third or whether it's a greater point, then it certainly is something that is very, very interesting for all of us. And one of the things that students of Bible prophecy wonder about are the timing and the sequence of events of end-time prophecy. So today I'm not going to be able to give you all of the events of end-time prophecy, but we'll attack this from one particular point of view, and that is where the Bible mentions days, dates, times, and seasons, and what those mean in various instances in the Bible. Now, understanding prophecy can be a huge challenge. There are so many moving parts to prophecy. When you consider Matthew 24, Revelation 6, the entire book of Revelation, and Daniel, and then all of the gospel accounts, the Olivet prophecies, the book of Acts, and everything that Christ said about his coming, it is very, very challenging to get it all straight. That doesn't mean you can't do it. That doesn't mean you can't have a pretty good understanding of these things. You certainly can. But be careful, too, when it comes to prophecy. I've hinted at that, and I'll hint at it a little bit more strongly today. In terms of coming to conclusions where the Bible doesn't come to a conclusion. So the information I'd like to give to you today is a very simple formula to help keep all of this straight. Well, I'd like to do that, but there is no simple formula to just keep all of this straight, because understanding prophecy is quite complex. It's like, how do you eat an elephant? Not that you'd want to eat an elephant. Yeah, I don't think anybody wants to eat an elephant, but if elephants were clean, you know, this massive thousands and thousands upon ton or thousands of pound creature, well, you do it one bite at a time. So today we're just going to do one bite. I know you're not going to eat an elephant, but we'll try to do it just with one little bit of information. We'll take a look at unwinding something that I think is very interesting in understanding Bible prophecy. But then again, I may be a little bit weird too. So something that is interesting to me may not be very interesting to you at all. So the title is Days, Dates, Times, and Seasons, and How Can You Better Understand the Events of the End Times? Well, studying them is one thing, but studying it from a particular point of view is very, very essential. My beginning point whenever I study prophecy is always with the basics. It's not with my own preconceived conclusions, because I've learned after almost 50 years of studying the Bible and studying Bible prophecy, you get hung up. I've seen it happen. You get hung up on your own predetermined conclusion. You're oftentimes wrong. Oftentimes wrong. And the church has been wrong. I remember Wolfgang Thompson, if he's listening in, he'll remember that the monitor in our room, maybe it was one of the hall monitors or room monitors, was an individual by the name of John Comino. And John Comino was a senior when I went to Ambassador College, and I arrived there in the fall of 1972. And I remember one Friday evening after Bible study, we were sitting around in our room, as we were wont to do, and we were discussing things about the Bible study and discussing things that were happening in the world at that particular time. And John remarked, we were the class that wasn't supposed to graduate. They graduated in 1973, but they were the class that wasn't supposed to even graduate, because by that time, the Great Tribulation should have already started, according to the calculations of people way back then in the church. So it's always stuck with me, and it's always been something that I've tried to realize, is that pinpoint as you'd like to, understanding every single thing about Bible prophecy is impossible, because there are going to be some things that you will not know that they have been concluded until after they have already happened. So how can you better understand the events of the end time? One of the ways is understanding this day for a year principle. Now, I've put some of the scriptures, not all the scriptures that we're going to go through today, but I think some of the most pertinent ones. And I'll offer you this. If you'd like this PowerPoint presentation, send me an email and I'll send it to you like I have in the past and several others. Of course, you're going to have PowerPoint to be able to open it, but to be able to look at it, you'll have to have the necessary software. But if you want it, then I can do that for you. There's a day for a year principle in understanding Bible prophecy, but you don't always apply it universally. You have to know when. You have to know when the context demands that you do so. So in Numbers chapter 14, and I'm going to go back a little bit further than this particular verse. I'm going to go to Numbers chapter 14 and in verse 26. Begin reading there. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who complain against me? I have heard the complaints which the children of Israel make against me. Say to them, 'As I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. The carcasses of you who have complained against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you who were numbered according to your entire number from 20 years old and above, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun.'" This was at the conclusion of their investigation into the promised land. The spies that were sent out to look into the land, two of them, Joshua and Caleb, came back with a good report, wanted to go in. The rest of them got the rest of the crowd, all the tribes stirred up, and they said, "No, we can't do this." And so because of that rebellion at that particular time, they were punished. And God withheld the promise of going into the promised land a day or a year for every day that they were in the wilderness up until that time. So that promise was withheld for 40 years. I'm going to see if there's any way, Joe, if I can make this a little brighter. I don't know if I can do that. So, maybe I can, maybe I can't. So here is the documenting. Does the screen get any brighter than that, do you think? This is Joe Anderson, everybody.
There you go.
Yeah, thank you. Those of you that are watching in, one of our tech gurus. Some of you know that. The passage here gives us a general principle of Israel's punishment, that they would be punished for 40 years, that everybody from 20 years old and up would die in that wilderness, and the only ones who would remain to go in are the ones that were under 20 years old and that were born in the wilderness, and they were the ones that inherited the promised land. In Joshua 5 and verse 6, "For the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness till all the people who were men of war who came out of Egypt." You know, the reason I put this in is to substantiate what is mentioned in Numbers 14:34, to show that indeed that is exactly what happened. Isaiah 34 and verse 8 covers the principle generally again. It says, "For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance," and speaking of another prophecy, "the year of recompense for the cause of Zion." So do you get it? Day, year. It's not to be applied universally in every single instance, as we'll see, and I'll show you. But so Joshua said that they walked in the wilderness for 40 years, to whom the Lord swore that he would not allow. Got a fancy. There we go. The Lord swore that he would He would not show them the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers that he would give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. So that's the general overall principle that is used to explain. Also, in Isaiah chapter 61 and verse 2, if you wanted to read that with me, I can cite that. That is another instance when this, where this principle is mentioned day for a year. Isaiah 61 and verse 2 says, "To proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord and the day of vengeance of our God to comfort all who mourn." That is speaking of the time of God's intervention. It may well be that that day lasts a full year after Jesus Christ's return, after his feet hit the Mount of Olives. So that day, and there are many passages in the Bible that say, in that day, or the day of the Lord, it may indeed last that long. Okay, so just FYI. So again, there's the principle there. Here's another principle in the title, times and seasons. In Daniel 2 and verse 20, Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his." Now, this is what Daniel said, either in prayer or to his colleagues, in Daniel 2, when King Nebuchadnezzar had this dream, remember? And he called all the magicians and all the astrologers, and he wanted them to make known to him the meaning of the dream and the dream itself. And they couldn't do it. And he said, "Okay, I'm just going to kill all of you then." Daniel intervened and said, no, don't let that happen. He told the king's guard, he said, don't let that happen. They prayed about it. And in verse 20, Daniel said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding." In this instance, Daniel is giving thanks to God for revealing the dream of Nebuchadnezzar and the meaning. He gives thanks to God for his wisdom and his power, and the inference in the original Hebrew is that God is in control. He's not changing times or altering things, but God is in control of all history and all prophecy. And he knows when these events are going to take place and how long each process is going to occur. And so Daniel could have that revelation and then give it to King Nebuchadnezzar. So you'll find the terminology times and seasons a number of different occasions in the Bible. And this is one of them. You'll find another one in the book of Acts, chapter 1 and verse 6. Acts chapter 1 and verse 6 through 8. This is the time just as Christ was ascending into heaven before the day of Pentecost. And of course, in Matthew 24, Luke 13, other of the Olivet prophecies, what was paramount on the mind of the disciples at that time? They wanted to know, are you going to now restore the kingdom to Israel? Is now the time that you're going to restore that kingdom? So therefore, when they had come together, they asked him, saying, "Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" And he said to them, "It is not for you to know times or seasons which the Father has put in his own authority, but you shall receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you shall be witnesses to me in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth." So, let me ask a question. You don't have to raise your hand. You don't have to answer it. I think sometimes that gets embarrassing if you answer a question that's asked upon in church. So, and I'm not trying to trick anybody. But let me ask you this question, and you can just think about it. Do you think that the answer that Christ gave in this particular verse is a general principle that includes every aspect of Bible prophecy and every time for God's people? Do you believe then, in other words, that it's never for God's people to know the times or the seasons which the Father has put in his own authority? You may, your answer might be yes or no, and you might be correct on both counts. You're correct if you come to the conclusion that, hey, it's futile to try to pinpoint a date far on the calendar into the future. Yes, you're right. It's not for you to know that time, and you're not going to be able to. I remember somebody mentioned back in 1996 to me privately at the feast, another minister, he had calculated that Jesus Christ's return would be in the year 2006. Now, unless I'm mistaken, then it hasn't happened. That was 9 years into the future, but it did not happen. So that is, you're correct if you say that it's impossible. But things change over a period of time. And if you'll notice in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 1 through 4, 20 years approximately after that Pentecost, 20 years after that time, the Apostle Paul was able to confidently tell the brethren that concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you. For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. Now, Christ said that in the Olivet prophecy, that it would take the world unaware. The people outside of God's people would be not knowledgeable, would be unknowledgeable of the times and the seasons in which they were living. Even though the gospel is promulgated through the end of the age, even though it's done until the time of Jesus Christ's return. But for the church, he said, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness so that this day should overtake you as a thief. So what had happened? What had happened in the intervening 20 or so years from the time that Christ addressed those same disciples? Well, Paul wasn't a part of them at that particular time, but the evidence is that he received the same instruction as the original apostles did. But this letter was probably written about 52 AD, and the church and the apostles had 20 years to consider the prophecies of the Old Testament scriptures along with the words of Christ. The point is, they had a better understanding with the broad outline of prophecy that was given, and to fully consider what Christ had told them on the Mount of Olives that evening just before his crucifixion, because he laid it all out there. He told them what was going to happen sequentially, and that's covered elsewhere in the book of Revelation by the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Then it gets really detailed, and boy, when it goes back and forth in time and everything, so it is quite interesting. But the broad outline of prophecy was even known by the disciples. It was in their memory banks because they had been given that information prior to Christ being taken away to be crucified, because he sat down at the Temple Mount. And they said, look at this unbelievable temple that Herod has built. And Christ said, hey, not one stone's going to be left upon another. And so that really intrigued them. This great, magnificent building with stones, some of them weighing 40 tons, would be toppled over and the temple would be desecrated. And that happened in 70 AD. Christ knew that. But then that really got the attention of the disciples, and they asked in Matthew 24, what would be the sign of his coming? And you have all these historical events that he recounted. There'd be wars and rumors of wars and false prophets and so on and so on, and continuing on and on. But in the book of Acts, if we go back to this particular verse, it is not for you to know the times and the seasons which the Father has put in his authority. There were more important things that had to be done first. And when the Holy Spirit came, in order for there to be a church, in order for there to be the fulfillment of the promise of Pentecost, they had to receive the Holy Spirit. It's as if Christ was saying, pump the brakes a little bit, guys. Stay in your lane. You know, just wait here. Wait here for the promise. It wasn't the time then to go back over this and to get them all excited about the institution of God's kingdom, because the institution of God's kingdom could not come until there was the beginning of the church. And so they had to wait. They were told to wait for the promise. And then when you go through Peter's sermon, he covers the whole panoply of prophecy in Acts chapter 2 and talks about that time from then on all the way through to the time of the heavenly signs and beyond, and goes through the whole panorama of prophecy. And so the understanding began then. And by the time that Paul was writing letters to the Gentile Christians in other parts of the world, they had a very good idea of times and seasons. They had a good idea of the general outline of Bible prophecy. So, another area that is always very interesting, and we haven't covered some of these things, they're kind of obscure in terms of prophecy is concerned, and we don't talk about them very, very much. And I'm introducing this because it's a topic that we haven't covered recently in context. I think we probably use Daniel 8 as a chapter. But you have to understand first the history of this particular time. So if you'll turn to the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 8 and verse 13, there's a very, very interesting prophecy here in Daniel 8 that was totally misinterpreted by the group that became the Seventh-day Adventists. They took a point in history during the Medo-Persian Empire, 457 B.C., and they added 2,300 years. In this case, they misapplied because they misunderstood the passages. They added 2,300 years on to a certain point. It may not have been 857. And they came up with 1844. And that was their time. I've referred to it in the History of the Churches series that we did not too long ago through the summer and the fall. And at that particular time, the Church of God Seventh Day, the group that became the Seventh-day Adventist, lost interest as groups in Bible prophecy, because that great advent didn't come along in 1844, but they totally misapplied and misunderstood the principle of the day for year. In Daniel 8, in verse 13, pardon me. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said that a certain one was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Now in this case, if you were to apply the principle of the day for a year principle in Bible prophecy, you would be wrong, because the context does not demand that you as the reader do this. So when you go back to the beginning of Daniel 8, we read, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, better make sure my phone's turned down now. Okay. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after one that appeared to me the first time. I saw in the vision, and it so happened that while I was looking, I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. This is now south of the area of Babylon, where Daniel had been taken captive, And since the kingdom had fallen to the Medes and the Persians, he was now somewhere down in the nation that we call Iraq, or Iran, pardon me. I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted up my eyes, and there standing beside the river was a ram, which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up fast. So, in verse 27 of Daniel 8, we get the context of this whole vision and dream that Daniel had. I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I rose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. So, this particular vision is covered in general principle later on in the book of Daniel. Daniel never got to understand exactly what this was all about. The time period in which this happened, we do know, dating it back to the third year of that particular king, the reign of King Belshazzar, about 550 BC. So that would be 11 years prior to Babylon actually falling, which it fell in 539 BC. So Daniel is told later in the book of Daniel, as you know, to shut up the words, Daniel 12 and verse 4, seal the book for the time of the end, many shall run to and fro and knowledge shall increase. It wasn't understood. The meaning of this vision in Daniel 8 wasn't understood at that particular time. Another clue that shows us the time period in which the prophecy will be fulfilled is found in verse 26 of Daniel 8. And the vision of the evenings and the mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. Now, what does the vision speak about? It speaks about the taking away of a daily sacrifice. For, and the word days is incorrectly translated in some translations. So in the King James and the New King James translation, if you'll read verse 14, in speaking about the 2300 days prophecy, in verse 14 it says, for 2300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Let me go back to verse 13. That gives it a clearer sense. Then I heard a holy one speaking. Another holy one said to the certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? 2300 days. But in all actuality, it's not 2,300 days, because there were morning and evening sacrifices, and it's further explained in verse 26. The vision is of the evenings and the mornings. That's when the sacrifices took place. So there were 2,300 sacrificial times in the evening and the morning that would take place over not a 2,300-day period, but a 1,150-day period. So I'll begin back to verse 4 of Daniel 8. I saw a ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any who could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west and across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. Now, historians have identified those people who believe that Daniel actually wrote this and was inspired of this several hundred years before the event, about 720 years prior to the event. They understood the four world-ruling kingdoms of Babylon and Persia Daniel is still in the kingdom of Babylon with one of Nebuchadnezzar's successors as kings. And he had this startling vision that he didn't understand, and it wasn't given to him to understand, and it wasn't going to be understood until the time of the end. And so in putting all of this together, you have the Medo-Persian Empire, which was then attacked, historically we know this, in 331 by Alexander the Great, and the Grecian Empire. And that's the meaning of these beasts or these goats and rams as we're going through. In verse 8, therefore the male goat, which is symbolic of a beast, symbolic of a kingdom, which is further defined in this chapter, became very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in its place of it, four notable winds came up toward the four winds of heaven. Or in modern language, from all areas of the compass. So we know this, that Alexander the Great began this mighty conquest of the known world, went all the way to India, died in Babylon after about 3 years in 328 BC. Out from his reign, the Grecian Empire grew into four distinct areas, four points in the compass, north, south, east, and west. And then it says in verse 9, out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. Now, the ultimate fulfillment of this is not till the time of the end, because that's what the chapter says. This information was going to be sealed. It was going to be information that was a prophecy that would be filled later on in history, in the many days in the future, as it says in verse 26. But what does this individual do? He goes to the glorious land, or the land that we would call Palestine, and it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars of the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as the high and as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. So daily sacrifices, which have not been in place in Jerusalem since 70 AD, when the temple was destroyed at that time by the Romans, will at some time, apparently, be reinstituted. Now, people get into trouble when they begin to determine, okay, I know exactly when that's going to happen, or this is going to happen then, and that. That's when you get yourself into trouble, prophetically speaking. Now, coming up to those conclusions which you've come up with in your own mind. Let me read from another, I think I've got another translation here. The beginning of this prophecy would not be fulfilled until 220 years after the time that it was given initially to Daniel. It concerned the overthrow of the Medo-Persian Empire by Alexander the Great, and that happened in about 328 BC. In verse 22, we know that this is speaking of kings that followed Alexander the Great, because it says, as for the broken horn and the four that stood up in his place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. So we know from history that Alexander's empire and it was divided by his generals after his death, divided into four distinct areas. In the south, you've heard of the Ptolemies, and they ruled in Egypt. In the north and the east, that was held by the Seleucid family. The northwest, going over to where Greece is, the area was under the control of a commander by the name of Lysimachus. And then in Macedonia, where Paul went on some of his missionary travels, or just close to it, it was dominated by Cassander. Eventually, those kingdoms combined until there were only two dominant ones, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. The Ptolemies in the south, the Seleucids in the north. So that gives you a kind of a bird's eye view or a thumbnail sketch of all of that happened in history after that. In verse 17, Daniel is said, so he came near where I stood, this angelic being. And when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. And what was he told to do in Daniel 12 in verse 4? Seal up the vision. This was one of those that was sealed up, and he would not know the answer to this great riddle, to this great prophecy. One of the keys of understanding this prophecy is understanding who the horn is in verse 9, and it's explained in verses 10 and 11. It's not just Alexander the Great. It's somebody that is going to appear as a great leader for all of mankind, and it's someone that is going to oppose God, and he's going to oppose what is thought to be one of the holy places of God in the time of the end. Revelation 17 and verse 4 also describes, I'm just going to read that here very briefly, Revelation 17 and verse 4. We've covered this several times, but Revelation 17 and verse 4 describes this same horn of the end time, not Alexander the Great or any of his generals, but in Revelation 17 and verse 4, it calls this whole system, it's 14, it's not 4, it's Revelation 17 and verse 14. It says, "These make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are the called and chosen and faithful." But I meant to go back to verse 12 and begin there. "The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast." That is what is meant by not his own power, not just by his own power. He'll also have the power, as in verse 22 of Daniel 8, it says, "As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power," or not with its own power. They will give their power over to that one horn. In the common English Bible, if you'll go down to Daniel chapter 8 and verse 12, from the common English Bible, maybe this is a little more clear. "In an act of rebellion, another force will take control of the daily sacrifice. It will throw truth to the ground and will succeed in everything it does. I then heard a holy one speaking. A second holy one said to the first one, 'How long will this vision last?' The one concerning the daily sacrifice and the desolating rebellion and the handing over of the sanctuary and its forces to be trampled. And he said to me, 'For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary will be restored.'" So again, sacrifices were offered twice a day, in the evening and the morning. So the time period being mentioned here is 1,150 days, not 2,300. The horn, or the leader, it says, will prohibit and cast truth down to the ground. It will prosper and it will make war with the saints. So there will be 1,150 days of sacrifices reinstituted in Jerusalem prior to the return of Jesus Christ. So when will these things begin? And when will they end? I will say that is unknown. That is unknown. Now, there are theories, there are ideas, and you may come up with some ideas or theories as to when those days and when those sacrifices will be instituted in the future and when they will be taken away by this beast power, because it's the same beast power that's spoken of in Daniel chapter 11. And it's the same beast power that is going to assault and savage not only God's people, but all of Israel. It's going to happen. Daniel 11 and verse 40 show the continuation of this same exact end time prophecy. "At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him with a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these three shall escape from his hand: Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon," or the people who are on the eastern side of the Jordan, the West Bank, and on the eastern side of Jordan, they have, as Ezekiel said, settled on their lees. They're the same people that have been there since ancient times. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, that is, the king of the north. And he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and oil, over the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. So, as we know, there will be a great European church-state union. Eventually, that union will be in control of all of Palestine. And actually, the whole Western world. They will be the dominant power in the world. The Bible says, this horn will prohibit the truth and cast it down to the ground. And it's going to prosper. Revelation says that the whole world is going to be amazed at the ascension to power by this particular beast power. It's also going to persecute and martyr the people of God. And it's going to be allowed to tread Jerusalem underfoot and prohibit a daily sacrifice at the sanctuary. Whether or not there will be a temple is unknown. So whenever somebody brings to me an article or a clipping from the Jerusalem Post where some rabbi is intent on building a temple and having a temple, I dismiss it because those times are not here yet. And there are other things that have to happen in the prophetic sequence before that's even going to be a reality. But when it does happen, and when they do actually institute sacrifices, you'd have to think that there's going to be a reason for them doing it. Now, the state of Israel today is somewhat secular. I mean, they have their religious fervor with the people who are very, very religious, but it's a very secular state, and it has been since the time of its formation in 1948. Jesus referred to this same event in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 15. Let's see if I've got it okay, not here. This was an additional scripture that I have. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Whoso reads, let him understand. Let them who are in Judea flee into the mountains, for then shall be great tribulation, climaxing in the second coming of Christ. And we see that from verses 15 through 21. The Bible says that the Gentile nations will tread down Jerusalem for 1,260 days. You'll also find that in Revelation chapter 11. It's a period which apparently includes this 1,150-day prophecy. It's also a time that the two witnesses will prophesy in the streets of Jerusalem for 1,260 days throughout the whole world. And then they'll be killed, as Revelation 11 shows. Not happy stuff, but just before, immediately before the return of Jesus Christ. And then they'll be raised from the dead in the sight of everyone. Apparently at Christ's return, along with all the rest of the dead who are raised in Christ first. So that brings us to, hopefully you have a little bit better understanding of the 2300 days prophecy of Daniel 8, which is actually a prophecy of the restriction of the sacrificial system, which is not in place now, and we don't see that happening. So you cannot begin, if you're going to start counting the days and where that 1150 ends, we don't really know, as I'll explain in a bit, but those 1150 days have not yet begun. So there's no temple. Doesn't mean that they have to have a temple to offer sacrifices, but they might. So we'll see. But that brings us to this series of events, which is mentioned in Daniel chapter 12. Here are days, 1,335 days, 1,290 days, 1,260 days, Daniel 12 and verse 11. Remember, we've talked about the daily sacrifice being taken away by the beast power coming in and stopping that. Probably, as we look back in history, in 168 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes was the successor of the Seleucid kingdom, and he then was the king of the north. But what he did was only a type, and it was a type of a fulfillment of Daniel 11 and verse 40. But he was this line of generals that followed Alexander the Great. He was the king of the north at that particular time. And he came into Jerusalem and overwhelmed it, set up a statue of Jupiter, probably a type of what is going to happen in the end time. So Daniel 12 and verse 11 says, "And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days." So you've got 1,335 days, 1,290 days, and then other spaces in prophecy, other verses in prophecy describe a time period of 1,260 days. And we'll get to that in just a minute. So Daniel 8 describes the daily sacrifices being taken away for 1,150 days, with the sanctuary cleansed, apparently, at the end of the 1,150 days. Daniel 12 and verse 11 shows the daily sacrifices taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up. That is when armies invade Jerusalem, and they will cause that abomination of desolation, whether it will happen in the same way as it happened in 168 BC with Antiochus Epiphanes setting up something in place of the daily sacrifices. We don't know. That's when you really see through a glass very, very darkly. So, would you like to know the answer? When do these days begin? 1,335. And when do they end? I'm sure you would. I would too. It's kind of technical. In one sense, it's kind of boring if you get all these numbers and, well, the times and blah, blah, blah. But just remember, they're there for a purpose. They're there to help us to understand that God is in charge and God is going to bring these things about. So we haven't written much about what these days mean, and for very good reason. There is nothing in the Bible that gives us a clue as to when these days do begin or when they do end. Now, do they all end at the same time with the return of Jesus Christ, or do they kind of overlap one another? Not going to touch that. I don't know. It's just, it is kind of interesting. Here is one person's speculation from 1979. A pretty good person, somebody that was a student of Bible prophecy all his life, Herbert Armstrong. He wrote in the Pastor General's report of November 20th, 1979, he speculated that the work of the church would cease at the beginning of the 1,335 days, and that the church would be readied for a 45-day period and taken to a place of safety, and that the church would be protected from the power of the beast for 3.5 years. Now, you'll have to associate that with Revelation 12 and verse 6 and Revelation 12 and verse 14, which, for the sake of time, I'm not going to go because it speaks about several distinctions there. 45 days later, or at 1,290 days, he said, the beast power would surround Jerusalem. And this would be the abomination of desolation, along with the cutting off of the sacrifices. So the 1,150 days could begin at that particular period. Daniel 11 and verse 31, just so you'll have it in your notes, because I know it gets kind of technical. Forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. This did happen under Antiochus Epiphanes. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. the Greek armies at that time surrounding Jerusalem. And they were repelled by Jewish patriots at that time, Judas Maccabeus and the like, and they were able to expel the Gentile or the Greek leader. Also, Daniel 12 and verse 11, from that time the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up. There shall be 1,290 days. And then also in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 15, come on. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee into the mountains. And it's verse 21, it says, for then there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. In order to really imagine this, you have to understand a world that is completely different than the one that you live in now. It is not going to be a world that is dominated primarily by Jacob or Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which they do now. There was a famous baseball player in the 70s and the 80s by the name of Reggie Jackson. And he was traded from the Oakland Athletics to the New York Yankees. And there he got a lot more attention and he became very famous and he became known as Mr. October because he always performed well in the clutch in a World Series. He told the reporters that as far as the Yankees were concerned, he was the straw that stirred the drink. That was sounded like a pretty vain thing to say. He was right. You're right. He was a great performer when it came down in the clutch, won ball games with home runs many, many times, and especially in the World Series, therefore earning him the nickname of Mr. October. The United States today is the straw that stirs the drink of the nations. Make no doubt about it. Despite any of the little problems that you see on the periphery or the people nipping at the heels of the president, the United States is in control of world events right now. So you're living in a world in which the United States has been dominant for over 100 years. That's all you know. Now, if you don't live in the United States and if you live somewhere else in the world and you hear this message, you may not take so kindly to that, but it's a fact. It's the most dominant nation. It's the protector of nations. It guards the sea lanes from pirates, all at your cost, all at your taxpayer expense. We are the nation that holds the peace, fragile though it may be at times, within this world. So to think about prophecy in the future, you have to think about a time in which the influence of this nation will wane. And that we will suffer for the punishment that God pronounces upon a nation that does not obey him. So you just have to think about that from that particular time frame. Zechariah chapter 14 is one that I don't have time to cover, but it's a very interesting prophecy that I'd highly recommend you read. It kind of flits in and out of future prophecy, and then after Christ's return, and what the nations will do, and what they'll be required to do after Christ's return. But it shows Judah fighting at that particular time, just prior to Christ's return, and being allowed to fight against the people that will surround them and surround their city. And it's a very, very interesting prophecy regarding the nature of Jesus Christ's return and his fighting against the nations. And all of the nations that are gathered, not just the beast power, but all the nations that are gathered in the Valley of Megiddo at that particular time. So I don't have time for that. We're going to move on to the next phrase that is mentioned in the Bible, time, times, and one half a time. I alluded to this earlier. Revelation chapter 12 is a chapter primarily about the church of God. Also, it's a chapter about the people of Israel in a larger sense, but it's a chapter about the church of God. And it says, the woman, which is symbolic of a church, was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time. A time meaning a year, which we've already established, times 2 years, so that's 3 years, and then half a time, 3 1/2 years. And so that is taking place. It can also be applied in a larger sense for the day for a year principle in which the church was hidden for a 1260-year period and during a time in which it was persecuted, but that's a topic for another time. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 25, this little horn that we spoke of earlier, and it's mentioned in Daniel 8 and also in Revelation 17, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. A 3.5-year period. Revelation 12 and verse 17 I've added there because I think that reference includes the 42 months. It's mentioned in Revelation 12 somewhere, 42 months, same 3.5-year period. So that's consistent throughout. So time, times, and half a time is also a time period that are mentioned. It's the same period as mentioned in Daniel, the time of 1260 days. We're closing in on one of the final principles, seven times, or 2520-year principle. This principle is applied mostly to the punishment of ancient Israel and the withholding of the blessings that were given to ancient Israel, because they went into the promised land and then they eventually were taken into captivity because of their obedience. And so all of the national blessings that were promised in Genesis 49, in Deuteronomy 33, to the sons of Joseph or the sons of Jacob, because he laid his hands on it, Ephraim and Manasseh, were never fully realized. But these two nations were poised to become dominant upon the world scene. And it begins in Leviticus 26 and verse 21. Three times within this chapter, it's up for there for you to read. When God puts something in one space three times, it means it's a very, very powerful statement. So what does it mean? Well, time equals a year. We've already established that. The sacred calendar year on the what you would call the Hebrew calendar, it's not a 365-day year. That's the Roman way of trying to adjust the calendars. The Hebrew calendar, the sacred calendar, is a 360-day year. And it consists 7 years, 12 years of, it's in a 19-year time cycle. It consists of 12 years with 12 months, and then 7 years, they have a leap month in, so they have 13 months. But they're all 360 days. Anyway, we adjust for that on the Roman calendar. But anyway, a biblical year is 360 days. So applying the day for a year principle, 7 times 360 gives you 2,520 years. And so how is that then applied? Well, if you take a look at the time of captivity, when ancient Israel, the 10 tribes up north, Samaria, the 10 tribes, all of them, they were taken into captivity from 721 to 718 B.C. If you subtract that from 2,520 years, where the blessings would be withheld for that particular period of seven times, you end up with one of the greatest times in history, with the emergence of the United States and Britain as world powers. And since that time, they have both been the dominant nations of the world, controlling the seas, controlling commerce, controlling virtually everything, even though all nations have been somewhat important. These two have been dominant. The 19th century, Britannia ruled the waves, and even prior to that, of course. The 20th century was called the American century, and it continues on. The blessings of God were conferred on these two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, but they were withheld after God punished them in a captivity. So this is when these two nations rose to power, and other nations rose to power, but usually in anarchy, usually in dictatorship, and usually resulted in what? the United States or British Commonwealth peoples, or all together, World War I, World War II, using their power and their might to put down the forces of fascism, communism, socialism, all through history. That's the age in which we live today, thankfully, because the world has been more peaceful with these two peoples holding all the other beast nations in check. And so we find the rise to prominence of these two peoples in the early 1800s, and you can just trace it. It's unmistakable. So that's the seven times or 2,520-year principle. And even when you take a look at the individual nation of Judah, it still applies because they went into captivity from 603 to 587, 585, around that general time period. And you subtract 603 from 2,520 and you come up to 1917. It may not be, mean a lot to a whole lot of people. But this was the time in the British Parliament when the British voted on and enacted what is known as the Balfour Declaration, which established a provision for a homeland for the Jews in Palestine, not just somewhere else in the world, but in Palestine, and the Brits had defeated the great Ottoman Empire, which had ruled the Middle East for 400 years, and they had just defeated them through World War I, and they had the ability to do this, and they did. Now, it wouldn't happen for another 40 years, but they primarily established this in 1917 at that particular time. So time equals a year. There's a day for a year. There's a 360-day year. In Daniel, I'm just going to cite this one because this one is a little more obscure. And back in the 70s and the 80s, we thought that this would be a little bit more prominent. But retrospectively, it has turned out to be not so prominent. Okay? Daniel chapter 4 and verse 25, and then verses 30 through 31, show this prophecy that Daniel had given to Nebuchadnezzar and said, look, Nebuchadnezzar, you're the greatest king on the face of the earth. But what's going to happen to you, which is prophesied by this dream, is that if you don't change and if you don't repent, God is going to give you the mind of a beast. And that's what's going to happen to you. And so in chapter 4, you find as you read through verses 30 and 31 that Nebuchadnezzar, proud of his kingdom, you know, look at, he's just wandering around the palace, probably going out onto the veranda, looking out over all of Babylon, those beautiful hanging gardens of Babylon. And he said, you know, look what all that I've done. And no sooner had he said that than all sanity went away from him. And it's a historically recorded fact that this great king for 7 years became raving and wild and lived in the wild, lived outside the walls of Babylon. And then his kingdom was restored to him. The fall of Babylon occurred in 539 BC. And you can read about that. And we have thought, or we thought around the time of the late 70s or early 80s, that this seven times prophecy would also apply to Babylon and its future rise, because if you've been paying attention to anything that I've written in the prophecy news updates, you know that Babylon is going to rise again. The system of Babylon, not the nation state, but the system from which this all began, going all the way back to the Tower of Babel and its confusion and its mystery religion and everything else that's associated, will rise again and become very powerful. We thought that this would also apply in principle. And if you take the fall of Babylon and subtract it from 2,520 years in times, seven times, you come up with 1981. And what happened in 1981? Well, the only thing of significance in our family was that our son James was born that year. But we thought about that time with the rise of Pope John Paul II and his call for European unification and calling for Europe to return to its roots, that tree upon which a band was put around it would begin to grow. And Babylon does need to grow. But we can never find any significance that I know of in the year 1982 of anything significance in that tree growing, because right now, religiously speaking, from a standpoint of Europe, it's not there. We one time thought that it might, and maybe someday we'll see some connection there. Who knows? But the main thing is, understanding days, dates, times, and seasons can be a helpful adjunct in understanding and better appreciating Bible prophecy. But remember what Christ said in Matthew 24, verse 44 through 46. This is the most important aspect of prophecy. You might not even have gotten an 85 on any quiz that I gave you today, especially if I only made 10 questions. You'd have to get a 90 or better before you had snacks. You might not have that, but that's not important. You know, you're going to forget 70% of what was said today by tomorrow morning, just because that's the nature of a presented message. I understand that. I'll forget some of it too. But the main thing is, Christ said, you need to remember this. Therefore, be also ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Not counting dates, not pinpointing individuals. That understanding is not going to do you any good at all unless you are prepared in a spiritual way.